Welcome to Current State on WKAR. Mark Bayshore is on vacation. I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. On the program today, we'll catch up with Michigan State University's Director of Broadcasting, the CEO of WKAR, Susie Elkins. Russ White visits with NPR news legend and MSU alumnus Don Gagne, and we'll hear the tale of Ash versus the Evil Dead, and bring you another installment from the Current State pop-up story file. All that's ahead on the September 20th edition of Current State from WKAR. Well, it's Thursday, and that means figuring out what's on tap for the weekend. And here's a question. What's your favorite way to spend a fall weekend when the Spartans are on the road? For me, it starts with a visit to our farmers' markets. It's fall canning and freezing season at the Westerman household. And we love those farm-fresh tomatoes and the hybrid sweet corn that MSU helped to invent. On my way up north last week to visit with some of my favorite Spartan farmers, I saw that Honeycrisp apples are in at Uncle John's. Brody Square had my favorite dessert combination this week, apple pie and dairy store ice cream. Is a visit to the cider mill in your weekend plans? Well, maybe not this weekend, as you heard Brooke say, that low-pressure area that's twirling counterclockwise to our southeast is supposed to be throwing moisture all across the WKAR listening area pretty much all weekend long. So here's your assignment. Grab a piece of paper and a pencil and write this down. This weekend, I'm finally going to, and fill in the blank. I need to decommission the pressure washer after cleaning out the garage and change the oil in the old snowblower. Got to write that email to my friends at the MSU College of Ag and Natural Resources to get advice on how to keep the squirrels from eating our pumpkins. But what is it that you've been putting up with all summer? Take that pencil and paper and write yourself that note. This weekend, I'm finally going to, and then write down one of those activities you've been procrastinating. Head over to KAR Current State on Twitter and tell us what's on your to-do list this weekend. We promise to tweet back some encouraging words to inspire you to do it. The first presidential debates in the history books, and a lot of you perceived it based upon how you watched it. The broadcast and cable networks each brought their own spin to screens filled with graphics and instant analysis. C-SPAN did a split-screen coverage of one of the cameras always on each of the candidates. PBS did its usual excellent job of trying to let the proceedings take center stage. And for those of us who listen to NPR's audio feed, the theater of the mind came into play. I sometimes feel it's easier to parse ideas with your eyes closed. We'll ask Susie Elkins that question and get her take on that topic a little bit later on. And let's begin with the CEO of this august organization. Susie brought 20 years of experience to her role as interim director of broadcasting at Michigan State when she was named to that post earlier this year. She's worked in just about every corner of the complex here at Communication Arts and Sciences and was a natural choice to lead WKAR through the continuing evolution of broadcasting, where content is truly king and the platform over which it's disseminated is changing. And full disclosure, we've been friends for years, and I have the honor of serving on the Dean's Special Advisory Council that's talking in depth about all these issues. Susie, welcome to Current State.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
How's it going?
It's going great. I want to thank you for being part of that advisory group. It's been so fun to talk things through with you and get your advice and really just think about the future of broadcasting, think about the future of WKAR and our role here on campus and in the community and across the region and really nationally. So there's lots to think about, lots to talk about, and certainly lots to do.
You've been making the rounds with your staff and the many constituencies that WKAR serves. What are they telling you and what are you telling them?
Well, I've really tried to mainly listen these past few months. I know them all quite well. As you said, I've been here for 20 years. And so there's a lot of really great people here that have a lot of ideas. And I've just been trying to open my door, ask them to come in, and I'm just trying to listen as best I can. And it's really been exciting because people have a lot of good ideas. They have a lot of thoughts that they've been anxious to share with me. And they're a little bit, I would say excited and also challenged by the state of media these days. There's a lot going on. Our industry is changing so much. And I would say it's pretty unanimous that everyone's excited to be in the business at this time. But it's also fraught with what do we do? Where do we go? How do we position ourselves? And I think we're not alone in feeling that way. But no, there's no shortage of ideas on how we might do that. So the challenge for me is listening to all of those ideas and trying to find some alignment and, you know, work with Dean David and you and the university to really figure out what our role can be and how we can move forward.
As a staff member, the worst place to be is in that unknown zone between when the feedback happens and when actions take place. How do you manage that? How do you keep people on even keel? All of us who lead teams want to know.
Well, yeah, I would like to know too. It is a challenge for sure. I think some people are really comfortable in that area of juggling ideas and thinking, about all the possibilities. And others really like to have a more targeted approach. And so they're less comfortable in that area of the unknown. So my challenge is to really think about each person individually and as we're talking, kind of help them along in a way that I think they'll be most comfortable with. But the one thing that's universal for all of us is we're going to be uncomfortable at this point, and that's okay. It's part of innovation. It's part of thinking in a new way, which is what we're all charged to do. So I just try to help people understand that the risk-taking is something that is encouraged and exciting, and there are no wrong answers at this point. So, enjoy it. Take the opportunity to try some new things and come up with some new ideas that you might not have otherwise wanted to share. We're in that space right now where I want to hear it all. I want people to push through and try to work through any ideas that they want to share and not be afraid.
You know, I was talking with Jarl Moen, who's the head of NPR, and he told me almost exactly the same thing that you've just told me. So this is a problem that not just NPR, but broadcasting in general is wrestling with right now.
I think so. And I think he's doing an amazing job. NPR is really knocking it out of the park right now. And, I mean, ratings are up. I think you probably saw their work with the debate and how popular that has been. And that's really the sweet spot for public broadcasters, I think, is that we need to move fast. We're competing with all other media organizations, but we have the ability to help listeners and viewers really think things through and not stay in that space of anxiety, but push through it and know that it's a part of innovation and moving forward, but helping to understand our world. So I think that's what he's been doing internally at NPR, but also helping us as listeners and as the country understand through NPR's work where we're headed and how we can deal with some of the anxieties that I think this particular election cycle has brought.
You know, and that really, I think, has been one of the reassuring things for me of listening to WKAR and NPR is it goes beyond just reporting what's happening, but trying to put some context around history. And that, well, Don Gagne, I'll talk about that a little bit later in the show, but that feels to me like the main role that we have as broadcasters.
I think so. I think adding that context and the important part for public broadcasters is we're lucky in that we're in each of these communities across the country, so we understand our communities better than anyone, and we understand what our anxieties are, we understand what our needs are, and we can add that context to these national stories. So that's the benefit that WKAR brings to our local community is adding that local context to these national stories. And I think in this new media context, the other opportunity that we have is to take our local context and share that with the world, especially a university licensee like WKAR with Michigan State University. We can really take the work that's being done here on campus and take that, add it to the national discourse and really present our ideas here in a global way.
You know, most people are listening to us live right now on 90.5, but a lot of people will be listening later on a device. And one of the things I think Jarl's done a great job with is the NPR One app. I love the fact that I can turn that on, get national news, hear Brooks local news, and then get to basically pick what I want to hear and pick up current state stuff. How do you see that impacting how people consume content?
Well, I think as media organizations, excuse me, we're really having to follow that consumer behavior. We're studying it. We're trying to understand it. And we're offering our content. We're offering that context. But it's really up to the listener and the viewer to, they're going to choose where and when they want to listen, how they want to view it. And it's been really interesting to watch that happen. I think that that's what will drive our work moving forward. And I think that eventually we won't even be dealing with schedules anymore. I think it'll be menu based, and the consumer will be choosing when and where. And I mean, they're already doing it. We're seeing that happen. Probably you record and you watch and listen to programming, just like you mentioned with the NPR One app. So I think that's exciting to me, because public broadcasters have always created content for niche audiences. We've always done that. We haven't had to create programming that appeals to the broad mass. We can do that, and we do that when it's appropriate, but we also create programming that's important for smaller niche audiences that wouldn't otherwise be served. So moving to these new platforms really serves that well, I think, because the consumer is going to choose what they want to hear when they want to hear it anyway, and we're producing programming and have been producing programming in that vein for a long time. So if you think about on the television side, you know, an old joke is, if you don't like what you're watching right now, wait half an hour and it'll be something completely different, you know. And, you know, commercial broadcasters aren't able to program in that way, but we were meant to program in that way. Well, now if it's being served regardless of what schedule we want to create, you can find it anywhere, anytime. You know, it's pretty amazing and exciting, and I think it opens up an opportunity for us to learn so much more about our audiences and contributors. And that's our job moving forward, I think, with the digital strategy that we need.
What is your message to the WKR faithful, the listeners, the people that are picking things up online, and most importantly, the donors, about the future of this organization?
I think the future's never been brighter. I think we're in such a great spot right now to give you exactly what you need to support you. Of course, you're supporting us, but I believe that we're truly supporting you and giving you what you need to understand the world as it is today, to giving you some insight and some context into some pretty overwhelming topics and situations that are happening in the world. And who better to do that than an organization like WKAR that's ensconced on this Big Ten University land grant, Michigan State. You know, it's just amazing. And I almost can't believe that I have this opportunity right now to think about how we do that moving forward with all these opportunities opening up in the digital space to find new audiences. So I would say thank you to our listeners and viewers, and especially thank you to our contributors, because you're making this kind of, I think, life-changing media available to your friends, your neighbors, to the families that can't otherwise contribute. And you're lifting the entire community by supporting this type of work, and you should feel really proud of that.
Amen. Susie Elkins is Interim Director of Broadcasting here at Michigan State University. A pleasure to play in the sandbox with you today.
Thank you so much, Scott.
Coming up on Current State, cast members from the Starz horror comedy Ash vs. Evil Dead are hosting a Season 2 advanced screening and Q&A panel tonight on the MSU campus. Actors Ted Raimi, Dana DiLorenzo, and Ray Santiago will join us live in the studio to talk about why Michigan plays such an important role in the new season. That's later this hour on Current State. You're about to hear one of the most familiar voices on public radio. What you might not have known is that it belongs to an award-winning journalist who got his start right here at MSU. Current State's Russ White has more.
So the first time I sat behind a microphone and recorded something onto tape was here at Michigan State University, and it was in Gary Reed's class, Introduction to Radio Production. I think it was a 201 level class.
That's Michigan State University alumnus and National Public Radio national political correspondent Don Gagne, whom you hear almost daily on WKAR radio.
And I had been the band announcer in high school and the PA announcer in high school, and I'd always kind of thought maybe I would have a career in broadcasting or something. But I sat down in that room and put something onto a reel-to-reel tape and listen back to it. And I should have quit right then and there. And I played it for Gary Reed, and he won't remember this, but he remembers it because he does this with every student, you know, going back. And he was like, okay, here's what you need to work on. You should try. And I came back for another day, and I came back for another day. And I don't think I ever got what you would call good, but something spoke to me. Something spoke to me. And that little spark I got here at Michigan State.
Gagne is a 1980 graduate of Michigan State University with degrees in both advertising and telecommunication.
I left here 35 years ago or thereabouts. And you carry the place with you everywhere you go. You just do. And when I was working in Detroit for many years, obviously I would bump into Michigan State graduates. But then I got to the White House Press Corps in Washington, and I was struck by the fact that those of us traveling in this relatively small bubble of reporters covering the President of the United States, there were all kinds of Michigan State University journalism graduates in there. And that was the first time that it really hit me that the reach of this school in my profession was so significant. No, I wasn't a journalism major. So maybe if I had been a journalism major, I would have known that while I was a student here. But graduating from this place and the things that I learned here with, you know, professors like Gary Reed, we're still friends today. And I've told him that the things I do every day at National Public Radio are things that he taught me to do when I was here at Michigan State.
Despite the quantum leaps in technology that allow us to enjoy Don and his colleagues' work in a variety of ways that suit our own preferences, Gagne says,
radio is not dead. Millions and millions and millions of people tune in every day. NPR's audience is in excess of 30 million very loyal listeners. We know how loyal they are every single week. So if you look at that as a percentage of the U.S. population, that's huge. But the way people are using this medium and getting the content that we produce for the radio is changing.
Gagne says National Public Radio's strategy to maintain and grow listeners in this new world of technology involves a renewed focus on telling good stories.
We are learning at NPR that our new listeners increasingly don't own or have never owned a radio. Even cars don't necessarily include a radio as standard equipment these days, as they once did. So that changes very much kind of how we perceive ourselves if we only think of ourselves as coming to people on this thing that, you know, has circuits in it and pulls signals out of the air. I like to think of radio as just an oral medium for telling stories. And to me, radio is, yes, I still tune in my, you know, public radio station on the FM dial or the baseball game on the FM dial when I'm driving around. But increasingly, if I'm listening to a baseball game, it's streaming off my iPhone through the MLB app. And I still get to listen to Dan Dickerson call the Detroit Tiger games. Is that radio? Technically, I guess it's not, but it is to me. It's the same. So it means we have a lot more competition, though, because we used to just be competing against the other radio stations. Now we're competing against every podcast, everything that people can do on their iPhone, looking at YouTube, looking at the latest clips from Comedy Central or whatever. So there's more competition out there, but all it means is we need to figure out ways to be great storytellers and to create compelling product. And National Public Radio and NPR News is doing that by continuing our commitment to great audio storytelling. But every radio audio story that I do also has a web version, so people can pull it up on a screen and read it as well. There are photographs and sometimes video accompanying those stories. NPR also does a lot of podcasting, things that never appear on the quote-unquote radio programs that we produce. All of our radio programs also exists as podcasts that can be listened to in their entirety, or they can be broken up into their individual component parts. So we wouldn't have recognized it if we looked back or looked ahead to this day from 1979 or 1980 or 1976 when I was in Gary Reed's radio production class in the Student Union building here. But I prefer to think of it as still just great storytelling that we deliver through whatever means possible.
Don Gagne cut his broadcasting teeth at WKAR at Michigan State University in East Lansing and at WDET in Detroit before heading to our nation's capital to cover the George W. Bush administration for NPR. He's now traversing the country covering the 2016 presidential election as national political correspondent.
I've covered every U.S. presidential election since 2000 full time, and I had a piece of earlier elections. And it is pretty stunning how much the way we cover elections has changed in that time. But the changes, while they have been very, very significant, you know, they've come along at a certain pace, and you just adapt to each one as it arrives. I remember sometime after the 2000 election getting my first BlackBerry. And it was like, oh, I can get email on the bus. And then I remember riding in the pool van with the press pool, following George W. Bush around as he drove from the White House in his limo. We were in the van in his limo up to Walter Reed Medical Center to visit some troops there, and all of the White House photographers, you know, from Newsweek and Time and the Wire Service were in that van with me. And we were on our way back to the White House, and they had their laptops up. And as we drove, they were looking for Wi-Fi signals coming from houses or buildings as we drove past so they could grab that signal and upload their photo. And I remember thinking, this is the craziest thing I've ever seen. We're in this van and they're sending their photos, and they're sending it wirelessly, even though we barely even used that term, because of something that's coming from that building that's parked there next to this red light that we're stopped at. And I remember thinking that was just crazy, you know? And now we're all, you know, tweeting Instagram pictures, and I'm jumping way ahead, but obviously, you know, we got to the point where we quit plugging in our computers with the little phone line that we would order in the press filing center, and now we've got hotspots and this and that. And that's just the technology, but the technology affects the storytelling. So now I'm at an event, and yes, I will do a radio story kind of recapping Jeb Bush's 12 hours in New Hampshire, and that story will air on the radio sometime after those 12 hours have completed. But along the way, I've posted a half a dozen photos to Twitter. I've posted Instagram photos. I've tweeted significant quotes along the way. I've already started telling the story and sharing the story with my listeners. Listeners, that's not even the right word, right? With the audience, before I ever sit down to start writing the story. So it requires that you be in storytelling mode the whole time and always looking for moments. And the trick is, and I think I've made the transition, but you're always aware that you're doing it, and you're always trying to make sure that you're in the moment. So I'm in the moment. I'm still watching the event. I'm still covering the event. But I have the ability to take 30 seconds and share this thing that just happened. So we're multitasking, obviously, but it's even more than that. It's not just doing that and doing this and doing this. It's figuring out the way to tell this story over the entire time that you're there. So that's the thing that's probably most different. The other thing is just the nature of the press corps itself is changing. And, you know, I came up in radio and kind of branched out to these other areas from there. But I still think of myself as primarily a radio reporter. And now we have, you know, journalists doing jobs that didn't exist. You know, they're working for news organizations, BuzzFeed and, you know, Slate and whatever. Though Slate sounds, feels like a venerable old place right now, doesn't it? Politico, for gosh sake, didn't exist back then. So it creates different kinds of pressures, and there are different kinds of stories being told. And it's not as staid and institutional as it once was. It's a little more freewheeling. And sometimes we complain about that, and sometimes we revel in that, but it just is, that is what it is.
Just as advances in technology have changed the way Gagné covers his beat, he says the technology has also changed how politicians interact with the media and with the public.
It's funny, I get wrapped up in talking about how the job has changed and the industry has changed and how you adapt to it over the years. On the other side of it, the politics have changed, and the way politicians go about getting elected and running campaigns has changed really, really, really dramatically. Again, they're using all of these tools. There are things that they're doing that we would have kind of been aghast had they done it, you know, 10 years ago. I'll get an email from the campaign, the re-election campaign of President Barack Obama. And the subject line will be, hey, you know, or hey, Don, you know, and then it's signed Barack at the bottom, you know, and it's now I get that not because I'm a journalist. You've gotten those probably because I signed up with their email list to see what they're sending to people. So kind of the casualness and the attempt to kind of make a personal one-on-one connection with people via Facebook and all that. So all of that is happening. And I think related to that is the nature of this election itself, this campaign itself. I tell people everyone's different. And they are different. Every election is different. Every campaign is different. Boy, this one is sure different. And the fact that Donald Trump, a non-politician, celebrity, billionaire, real estate, reality show host guy is leading the way for the Republicans. But the candidates that we thought would be at the top aren't at the top. And candidates that we couldn't imagine would be at the top are at the top. And, you know, we had a little taste of that 4 years ago when Herman Cain had his run at the top. And then Newt Gingrich was at the top for a while. And then Michelle Bachmann was at the top. But this is that to the nth degree. And some of it is because of all the money that can pour in. And there isn't the normal weeding out process. Some of it is the way these debates are really like reality shows in and of themselves, attracting huge audiences. There are a lot of incentives for people to jump in, which fragments the field even further, which allows someone with a relatively small percentage to get a lot of buzz because it puts them near the top of the field. And don't ask me to make any predictions as to not just how it's going to turn out, but what it's going to look like in 2 weeks. It's quite a thing to watch, and it's quite a thing to try to keep abreast of.
That's MSU alumnus and NPR national political correspondent Don Gagné. And I'm Russ White for Current State on WKAR.
Don Gagné, NPR News, East Lansing, Michigan.
You can hear more from Current State contributor Russ White on MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 and on AM 870 at that same time, and anytime at SpartanPodcast.net. Coming up on Current State, we'll have another pop-up story from our August event at Red Cedar Spirits, where the theme was The Heat Is On, great Glenn Frey tune. That's coming up later this hour on Current State. That's master blues guitarist Mary Flower riffing on The Ruckus Rag. Mary was our guest on Live Music Friday 2 weeks ago. You might remember her riveting performance. Tomorrow we welcome Zach Pohl to Studio S. He's a singer, guitarist, songwriter who blends folk music with a touch of soul, based in Austin, Texas. And by the way, he's not the Zach Pohl who's the son of current state Scott Pohl. Zach Pohl, our featured Live Music Friday guest tomorrow on Current State here on WKAR. We hope you'll join us. If you like horror films, you'll definitely know about the classic Evil Dead trilogy starring Bruce Campbell and Ash Williams. And if you're a big fan of those films, then you were pretty excited almost 25 years later. The story picked up again with a Starz show, Ash vs. Evil Dead. Season 2 of the show premieres this weekend, and Michigan plays an interesting role in the story, probably because the creator of the films, Sam Raimi, is one of us. He attended MSU, as did his brothers Ted, who stars in season two, and Ivan, who is executive producer. Cast members will be at MSU's Wells Hall for a Q&A panel and free screening tonight. And some of them join us now. Here with us are Ted Raimi, Dana DiLorenzo, and Ray Santiago. Thank you for joining us, guys.
Thanks for having
us. Good morning.
It's great to have you all here.
Thank you.
To get started, we have a clip from the season two trailer so we can give listeners a little sense of what the show sounds like.
We're going to go to Elk Grove, Michigan. That's my hometown. And put an end to this horse pucky once and for all.
Whatever happened in this town seems to really haunt him.
Ash, I had to summon you. Help me retrieve the book and send them back to hell.
That is awesome. Ted Raimi, for those of us who haven't seen Evil Dead's movies or Ash versus the Evil Dead and have no idea what's going on, can you bring us up to speed on the story?
Sure. Okay, so Ash versus Evil Dead is the television version of the popular trilogy of Evil Dead pictures. Evil Dead 1, Evil Dead 2, and finally Army of Darkness. So for years and years, fans have been clamoring for Bruce Campbell, Sam Raimi, and Rob Tappert to give them more movies. They want more and more and more. So as sort of a weird gift, they said, well, stop complaining about the movies, and we will instead give you 70 or 80 half-hour episodes of the show. So I imagine that, I hope that that will, you know, ease their desires, but it seems so popular that they'll probably want the movies too based on the television show, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. But Ash is the story of a dumbbell named Ash Williams, played by Bruce Campbell, who inadvertently releases evil into the world from this old and ancient book that he finds while being in a cabin in the woods, in the Michigan woods. And this evil is unleashed. Chaos ensues, blood is spilled, and this poor imbecile, Ash Williams, is our only hope for the future. And it's a terrible hope. This guy's really, like I said, a dumbbell, so we really have little hope.
A complex character.
Not so much, but yeah.
And tell us about your character in the show. You weren't in season one, but you're joining in season two.
I am. I'm very lucky to be on this show. And, of course, with me today is the amazing Dana DiLorenzo and Ray Santiago, the new cast members of the show. I'm really the new one, but I was in the original three pictures, so it's weird. I'm new and old, so it's odd. My character's name is Chet Kaminsky, and Chet's a Detroiter. And you know that because he's got a Hamtramck T-shirt on half the time, who stayed in this little town of Elk Grove.
Yeah.
And now Chet has very little ambition. Ash has some, Chet has less. And Chet hangs around this town. He works at a bar, and for fun, he makes drinks laced with ketamine. Yeah, that's right. I said it. Ketamine. Special K drinks, which he uses just to entertain himself. That's about his whole life.
Dana, I want to hear about your character. Tell us about what you do in this.
I play Kelly Maxwell, who is the tough chick with brains, who is the counterpart to Ash in that she gets him to think first and then shoot, whereas his motto is shoot first, think never. So she's like, nah, let's come up with a plan here. And she got dragged into this fight against evil because her best friend, Pablo, got her this job at Value Stop. And like Ted said, when evil came looking for Ash Williams, all of a sudden that involved her mother coming back from the dead. By the way, spoiler alerts for season one if you haven't seen it. Mother coming back from the dead, putting a fork through her father's eye. Then she gets possessed, and then chaos continues to ensue. So in season two, she continues to be the tough thinking, but how would I say this on the radio? Chop busting. She busts his chops a lot.
Chop busting. I got to remember females, that's a good line.
Yeah, chop busting. That's a better way than how I've been saying it. A female sidekick to Ash and
And it's quite a journey.
Right. And what do you do in all of this?
I play Pablo, and Pablo is Ash's... Pablo is this idealistic immigrant who meets Ash at this store and realizes that evil is lurking in the world, and based off of his past, believes that Ash is the man to save the world from evil. So, he goes on this journey with Ash to save the world from evil. And, Pablo's a pretty cool character because he's sort of the first Latin American male sidekick to a horror genre on television. So it's really cool because what we're doing with the television show with adding Dana and I, we've sort of opened up the demographic and opened up the show to a whole new generation for the youngins who haven't seen it. And it's a pretty great show, and the fans have embraced us, and I'm just excited for everybody to see season two, which, as we said, airs October 2nd, and season one is available on the Starz app, which your listeners can download.
Did you hear that? How well they promote? They've obviously done this before. Ted Raimi, we've heard that Ash mentions Elk Grove. How much of the role does Michigan play in season two?
Huge. It all takes place in Michigan, in fictional places in Michigan. So, for all of you Michiganders who are going to state, you'll know there is no Elk Grove. There's right away. But it's supposed to be your standard sort of, probably like 25,000 population, small Michigan town. It'd be like Gaylord. It'd be a lot like Gaylord. And it's supposed to be around the same place where Gaylord is. I imagine the writers probably set that as the template. Yeah, it's all over Michigan. There's mentions of Detroit, and in Ash's bedroom, our hero's bedroom, we see his old bedroom, and there's old Iggy Pop posters. There's St. Andrews Hall, rock, memorabilia. There's Faygo pop bottles. There's Buddy's pizza boxes everywhere. So
home improvement on steroids.
Yeah, it's just you're in Detroit, but the funny thing is we shoot the show in Auckland, New Zealand.
Because when you think Detroit, you think Auckland, New Zealand.
That's right. Yeah. And so the producers of the show, incidentally, the guy, the executive producer is Rob Tappert, who is from Grosse Pointe, Michigan.
Right. Yeah, this is a Michigan.
It's a whole family. Michigan. Yeah, it's strange. Like, we've all been transplanted, to New Zealand. But there, they've rebuilt Detroit. So it's strange. It plays so big in it that they decided to move the entire city, in essence, to Auckland, New Zealand. So it's surreal. So, you're around people that say, oh, yeah, matey, there you go. And, you've got Detroit, Michigan here. But you're not in Detroit,
clearly. There's a Renaissance Center. Yeah.
What's that? Yeah.
Dana, this is a horror comedy, so there's gore and jokes together. What's it like being on the set?
I think, especially in season two, when we have people like Ted joining us and who has such a history with Bruce and Lucy, I think people would be surprised at how much we actually laugh on set. Mm-hmm. We take it all very seriously, and of course there are tough days, but we've really just become such a family that we will shoot, 14 hours a day, 6 days a week, and then on that one night that we have free to ourselves, we're still hanging out.
Still hanging out. Just like Spartans do.
Exactly.
And incidentally, what Dana's talking about is unusual for a television show.
Is that really so true, Dana?
In my experience, yes, I think that we are very, very lucky that that people like Bruce and Lucy and Ted have accepted Ray and I into the mix in a way that we felt like we were meant to be here all along. But it's especially in season two, watching Ted and Bruce together off screen as well was like watching a variety show, that a timeless variety show. Like, it was they need the Ted and Bruce hour to come back, because it was quite a show. Like, just doing impressions with each other and keeping us all laughing, it was pretty, pretty fun.
It sounds like there's a behind the scenes program here somewhere. Ray Santiago, what's it like joining a series in midstream like this?
What's great about this opportunity is that I get to work with cult classic icons. I really do believe that Sam Raimi created this genre in the early 80s. And I get to work with people like Bruce Campbell and Lucy Lawless, who,
sure, she's a legend.
They've both had such longevity in their careers, and they've been around for so long. So I just try to go to work and observe and absorb as much as possible, because in some ways what they've done by adding us to the franchise is sort of in trusting that we will be the leaders or the newbies of the franchise for tomorrow. So it's an amazing opportunity.
They're both being very modest, both Dana and Ray, and I'll say that this show is unusual in that it's both horror and comedy. And to walk that tightrope is challenging. You go a little bit to the left, and you've got just gore and horror, and you go just a little bit to the right, and you've just got a light comedy with some weird blood in it. So it really requires a tightrope walk, and these two guys really have that in spades. Both of them do it so well, and now, you know, when Bruce and I in 30 years from now have, you know, are in wheelchairs with tubes coming out of our mouth and ears being fed by nurses, these guys will be then breaking in the fourth or third generation, you know, of Evil Dead, hopefully. So they're
Ted,
great.
Ted Raimi, do you think it's possible for someone who doesn't like horror to get hooked on this series?
Yeah, you can start liking anything.
It sounds like it.
Yeah, it's its own animal, don't you guys think?
I think so. And I have to say, what's been really great when we've been going to different conventions and meeting fans face-to-face, I have to say I was shocked because I'll have a family come up to talk, and it's a grandmother all the way down to like a 15-year-old grandson, and she said, you know, I never liked horror, I never watched these movies, but I watch the show because my family watches, and we get together and watch the show on Sunday nights and loves it. She's like, that Bruce Campbell just makes me laugh. So I find that, like Ted was saying, because it has all of these elements and also some drama and also action, that it's 30 minutes of just pure entertainment. So whatever you like, I think you will find in there.
But that said, this show is not for children.
Actually, I beg to differ because I have...
Ray Santiago, tell us why.
I'm so sorry because I have actually met, like Dana was saying, we meet some of our fans at these conventions, and I met a 9-year-old who's come to multiple conventions and named his hamsters after Kelly and Pablo. So he's watching with his mom and dad, and they're letting him watch. And I've met kids that are really into the show. And when I was that age, I too watched horror films. So to be...
I did too, but look how we all turned out. You think you want kids to come out like we did?
I think you guys probably are doing a pretty good job because you inhabit characters, but they aren't you. Isn't that the story?
I do think that people have the misconception that the show is super scary all the time and that they don't want to watch because of that. But I've learned from audiences that they are surprised at how we jump from tone to tone. So it's super comical. It's kind of gory and scary, but it's really just a fun, bloody ride that happens really fast.
The challenge, too, is that typically in horror pictures, it's a one-off. You know, you can scare the audience with a pretty basic concept. There's a ghost in the house or someone's possessed or there's a spooky place that someone has to go and deal with generally a group of teenagers and girls getting slashed. But the question, the challenge, I guess, for this show is how do you sustain that over years? And so I think a big answer is the writing staff is amazing. Rob Tappert has structured it, our executive producer, in such a way that you can sustain it. And Dana and Ray are pretty amazing actors, and they can take something that's challenging like that and turn it into a character-driven piece as opposed to just a bunch of, you know, spooky scares.
Thank you guys for joining us. Season 2 of Ash vs. the Evil Dead premieres October 2nd on Starz. Or you can go to Wells Hall tonight. What time is it tonight, guys? It says 11:15 on here. That says lunch hour to me.
All three of us want to party with you.
Thanks so much for joining us on Current State.
Thank you.
We'll have another pop-up story from our August event at Red Cedar Spirits, where the theme is The Heat is On. Let's hear storyteller Nancy DeJoy tell us the tale of adventure, fear, and heat from a bike race you'll never forget.
Remember when you were young and your bicycle was still a source of freedom? I remember the first time my dad let go of the seat of the two-wheeler I shared with my sister, and I took off down the sidewalk on my own. I still remember riding that bike with a cast on my leg because I couldn't face the 6 weeks I was supposed to stay off the thing. I started riding regularly again a few years ago when I met Dan, a real bike enthusiast with some of the coolest and smoothest cruisers I've ever ridden. The wind in my hair again and the pumping of the pedals was the best shot of youthful joy I'd had in years. So last summer when we went up north, we decided to go to Bel Air for the Glacial Hills Mountain Bike State Championship. This is a serious heat with categories for riders young to old who are riding to claim statewide victory. But other people ride too, just for fun, or so I was told. It was a hot day and we hadn't planned to ride. In fact, the night before we had a rich dinner and I had a few drinks. I was wearing a black skirt and tank top with a white silk scarf and large hoop earrings to add a little style to the outfit. At the last minute, Dan decided he wanted to ride and that I should give it a shot too. Now, he's a former motocross champion, so he's a little different from me. All I had with me was a cruiser, so we rented a bike and got me some new gloves, and I entered in the amateur women's 40 and older group. Did I mention it was hot? Within minutes of registering, they announced the start for my group, and the heat was on. I rounded the first corner of a deceptively easy hill on the road to the trails and faced a steep incline even before I got to the trail entrance. In fact, the incline was so long and so steep that Dan, whose group had started well before mine, assumed that I had just turned around and that he would find me at Short's Bar waiting for him when he finished the race. But I was curious and naive, a combination that sometimes will serve you well and will sometimes make you sore in one way or another for days. I thought at least it would be cooler on the trail in the woods. I was far behind everyone in my group by the time we even got to the trail, so there was no one to follow. I'd never ridden on a trail like this before, but I figured I could follow the markers, which would have been okay, but the trail was mismarked, so I ended up on the expert men's track. I knew something was wrong, but I figured the best thing to do was to keep going, so I did, up and up and up and up and up and up until I was sure that every next corner couldn't help but start the path downward back to town. I thought this for about 2 hours, and then I gave up using any energy at all except to pedal and hope I wouldn't die on that mountain. Surely they would send someone to look for me if my legs actually gave out, and they were burning. At one point in my despair, I wondered out loud why Dan would do this to me. What had I ever done to him? Would I ever ride again with that sense of freedom and joy that I had so recently reconnected with? I was getting angry, and I was scared, and the heat of the two emotions had me rattled. That's probably why I passed the vans stationed at checkpoints for riders who wanted to quit. What was to be about a 12-mile low-intensity ride was turning into 26 miles of grueling terrain. I was hot from the inside out and learned that day what it must be like to need water so badly that your body temperature actually rises. At what I guess was about mile 16 of the straight, constant climbing, I tried being philosophical about it all. After all, I was lost on a trail, and the irony of that didn't escape me. I hadn't seen another rider in a very long time. The heat was on to make it out of the woods. Everyone else had finished hours earlier, literally hours earlier. And really, the race was over, even though the day dragged on as people waited for me to come around the corner alive. Dan was pacing. The race organizer was frantic about looming disaster. They had already consulted with the police to see if they would sweep the trail soon if I didn't emerge. I don't think I'll ever forget the feeling of relief I had when I finally turned a corner and started going down instead of up. In one of those unexplainable geographies of life, even though I had been going up for over 3 hours, it felt like I was only going down for about 30 minutes before I hit the road and started down the final hill to the finish line. The announcer called out my name as I crossed, and a sigh of relief went up from the crowd. Dan had seen me coming and was ready to take the bike, get me to the curb, and give me water and a banana. After about 20 minutes, I was able to walk, so we made our way to the free beer. I ended up fifth in my class, only because some had not finished and just missed getting a medal. But I was not on the DNF list. I was not on the did not finish list. Sometimes it's enough to make it to the end when you're hot and the heat is on.
A great tale from MSU professor Nancy DeJoy. And once again, we want to remind you that tonight is our last Pop-Up Stories live storytelling event of the year. It's at Reach Studio Arts Center at 6 p.m. For more information, you can find us on Facebook at Pop-Up Stories Lansing or on WKAR.org. Hope to see you there tonight. And don't forget that Ash versus the Living Dead, Evil Dead, is tonight at 11:15 p.m. Mark Bayshore back in the saddle tomorrow to finish out the week. He'll check in with Great Lakes commentator Gary Wilson on some of the biggest environmental stories that made headlines in September. It's our monthly Great Lakes Month in Review. It's our favorite day of the week here at WKAR tomorrow, Live Music Friday. We welcome roots music artist Zach Pohl. Zach hails from Austin, Texas, the live music capital of the world. For 2 years, he played bass, sang lead vocals, and wrote songs for the group Madeira. He went solo in 2008 and travels 2008 and travels across the country honing his craft. Zach Pohl, our featured live music guest tomorrow on Current State. I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Thanks for joining us and have a fantastic day.